By the way, this is my favorite music from the entire Star Wars saga, Duel of the Fates, which we first hear in episode 1. I thought it was really quite epic, quite amazing. Yeah, really, really something. So anyway, so I decided to do another podcast today about Star Wars. Now, for some reason, I usually like to prefer to write my ideas down. Because I'm a writer, I'm not really much of a speaker, and I'm not so good at making YouTube videos. I think that's a skill that you have to kind of learn. What I wanted to talk about is, you know, for the past 15 years, it seems like, ever since the first of the prequels came out, I have been arguing with people about the prequels. And I actually find it interesting because all of that sort of passionate hatred that people have for those movies, it just seems to sort of push me in that direction that kind of leads me to think that those are actually really good movies. Because for me, art is something that gets people to feel very passionate one way or another. And I think too often nowadays, we are sort of used to art by committee. You know, art is no longer something that people create to express a singular vision or a perspective. And that was the original goal of art. And anyone that has a historical knowledge about art can tell you that the kind of hatred that has been directed at the prequels have been directed to many artists in the past. You know, when Picasso first unveiled his cubism, people hated it. People hated it with a passion. And they thought that the guy had lost his mind. And it took a very long time. It took years, many years, for people to really appreciate cubism. Same thing with Impressionism. You know, when Van Gogh was alive, his Impressionism was not appreciated. Another example that I like to give is the sculptor Rodin, who's famous for having made The Thinker. Now, he was very beloved for The Thinker, but he also made a statue of Balzac, the French author. And this statue was so hated by the French people that it was hidden away in a warehouse or a building, I don't know exactly what. So and nobody saw it for decades because people hated it so much. So this idea of art being something that everybody loves and everybody enjoys, that's not what art is. It's not what art is supposed to be. And you know, you have people saying, well, the problem with Lucas is that he didn't have a guy to tell him no. He was surrounded by yes men. He was surrounded by people, you know, that just did whatever he said. But the thing that people don't really consider is that in other forms of art, there are no people. You know, authors don't have a guy sitting beside them when they're writing saying, no, you can't write that. Painters don't have people next to them saying, you're not allowed to write that. That's wrong. You know, you have to paint in a different way. I don't like that, what you're doing. And independent filmmakers usually are by themselves. And Star Wars has always been an independent film. And the fact that people are so angry, they get so passionately angry about Star Wars, leads me to think that it is not your typical Hollywood film. It is not a film made by a group of people in a boardroom somewhere deciding what is the best course of action. Because that's how most movies are made. That's how Marvel movies are made. That's how most big blockbuster films are made these days. And it actually kind of makes me sad. Because I don't want a committee to try to figure out what is it that I want to see. You know, what are the kinds of things that interest me, and let's make that, or let's take a, you know, let's democratize art. Let's get a democratic consensus as to what do people like, and only make that. And that's never been what art is all about. Art has always been about the creator. You know, I hear people saying, you know, Lucas is so arrogant for thinking that all that matters is his vision. Well, when you're making a work of art, that is what matters. It's your vision. I like to know how he thinks, how he feels, what you know, what is his view. And it's such a rare thing to see something like that in Hollywood. It's such a rare thing to see a movie like that, that it's refreshing to me to see something that sometimes is offensive, sometimes I don't agree with, sometimes I hate, sometimes it's cringeworthy. It's not that I'm watching these movies and I'm saying, you know what, all this, you know, dialogue that's terrible, all these cringeworthy scenes that are that make, you know, that people think are atrocious. I feel the same way. I think a lot of the same things that the haters see, I see them also as being awful, you know. However, I think that one of the reasons that people love Star Wars with a passion, I think, greater than any movie franchise, and this includes Lord of the Rings, this includes, you know, the Harry Potter movies, this includes the Marvel movies, people have a real passion for Star Wars, a deep, deep, deep love for it. And I think that love comes from the fact that it is not like other movies. It is a work of art. And that sensibility came from the way that Star Wars was made from the beginning. And from the very beginning, Star Wars was made in 1977 by someone who had a singular vision. Now, some people could say George Lucas has lost his way, he's become a different person. But I say thank God that, at least at that time, we allowed for that sort of singular vision to be put on film. Because if it wasn't, we wouldn't have Star Wars. If George Lucas made movies following sort of the formulaic Hollywood system, you know, then Star Wars wouldn't exist. And I really think that with the prequel movies, he really broke with the mold tremendously, because we see things in the prequel movies that we don't see usually in Hollywood movies. We're seeing a space opera fantasy adventure, which is also a political movie. Now, usually those two things are separate. Like, if you'll go to the theater and you'll either see a space adventure fantasy or you'll see a political drama. You won't see both in the same film. And the reason for that is because Hollywood people get together and they decide, they say, okay, we're going to make a movie for people that like politics. And they make that movie. Now we're going to make a movie, a space adventure, for people like space adventures. Well, people like space adventures don't like politics, so they're not going to be interested in that. So those two things will never cross paths in a regular Hollywood film. That's why I'm happy that George Lucas is allowed to make those movies, because otherwise it would never exist. Now, some people might say, who cares? I never want to see politics in my space adventure. I don't want to see Guardians of the Galaxy where they're talking politics. Well, that's fine, but I do, and I'm glad that that movie exists for people like me who does want to think about those things, who likes to think about the politics of another civilization, of another galaxy, you know? Also, when you look at something like Revenge of the Sith, what we have is essentially a Greek tragedy in a very classic sense, We have a character that looks into the future, sees the future, does a lot of terrible things to try to prevent that future from happening. And then, in his efforts to try to prevent that future from happening, causes that very future to happen. Revenge of the Sith very closely mirrors an ancient Greek tragedy. And again, where are you going to see a science fiction fantasy movie that pretty much follows an ancient Greek tragedy? I mean, that's just not something that people want to see. And if you had a boardroom of Hollywood executives who are saying, you know, we're going to make this $100 million budget movie, no one is going to suggest to make such a film. No one is going to say, let's do a Greek tragedy, but have it, you know, take place in space. This isn't going to happen. And, you know, and what I really hate in movies is I hate formula. I hate movies that are made by committee. I hate when I'm sitting in a movie and I feel that the people that made that movie were catering to my expectations. I don't want to be catered to. I want to be somewhat disturbed by the things that I see. I want to be bothered. I don't mind that, you know, there's a scene in the movie that I feel, you know, maybe didn't have the best acting, or maybe the direction wasn't the best. That's why I was kind of brokenhearted when Disney bought Star Wars. Because I felt like, okay, now that Disney bought Star Wars, we're going to end up with a lot of Star Wars movies that are very formulaic, that follow that Disney formula. I don't think Disney's going to have a movie where one of their heroes ends up murdering children. That's not going to happen in a Disney film, you know? And this is why I so adored the prequels. I still adore the prequels. Because you're seeing things you just would not expect to see in a regular movie. And that, to me, makes it a work of art. And I think it's good to have works of art. Now, as far as all of the things that the prequel movies do badly, I've actually listened to some of Mr. Plinkett's Red Letter Media complaints about the prequels. And I agree with some of what he has to say, and I also do disagree with a lot of the other things he has to say. But ultimately, I think that it would be very easy for him, for someone like him, to look at the very first movie, A New Hope, and find just as many, if not more, mistakes in A New Hope and in Empire Strikes Back. There are a lot of problems in A New Hope, but let's just look at A New Hope. Okay, because that's the movie that started it all, and it was the movie that was directed by George Lucas and created by George Lucas. So people say, George Lucas can't direct, George Lucas is terrible. Well, you gotta wonder, how in the world did he make one of the most beloved, if not the most beloved movie of all time, if he's so terrible? I think the answer is that he hasn't completely transformed into a totally different person that can't direct. I think a lot of it has to do with the time. 1977 was a very different time than 1999 and 2002 and 2005. Very different time. There's different expectations. There's different ideas. We see movies very differently. And also, you know, it wasn't 40-year-old people that were going into Star Wars, Episode 4, and saying, oh my God, this movie changed my life. I mean, even if you were, you know, an older person and you love Star Wars, I'm sure that wasn't the movie that defined your generation. You had to be a kid to say that this movie defined my generation. So let's look at A New Hope. Let's consider A New Hope. Now, right from the beginning, we have a fussy robot, C-3PO, and R2-D2. And the thing that I always thought was a little awkward about R2-D2 is that in a galaxy where they can easily make it so that robots can talk, because C-3PO can talk, R2-D2 doesn't talk. Instead, he does blips and beeps. Now, you might say, well, that's okay because he's only an astromech droid. I mean, his job isn't to interpret or to talk to people. His job is to fix things. But we have cell phones that talk to us. I don't see why it would be impossible to have given R2-D2 a voice. Especially if, you know, you're saying, hey, R2, what's wrong with Maxwing? Maxwing is breaking. And all he can do is beep at you. And then the really awkward thing is that everybody just somehow just knows his language. Luke, Leia, everyone just knows what he's talking about, even though he's beeping and blipping. It's not very realistic, but people find it cute and funny and endearing, so do I. It doesn't bother me, but I imagine that if we were to scrutinize the original movies the way we scrutinize the prequels, we might say, that doesn't make any sense. Why can't R2-D2 talk? Why does he just do all these bips and bloops and bleeps? Later on in the movie, we have Princess Leia. She gets zapped by a stun gun. Now, this is a really cool weapon. It's a cool effect even back then. But when she gets zapped, we never see this again, ever. We just never see it. It, you know, maybe that's a minor quibble, but I just think it's odd that there's this really cool weapon. It's never even brought up again. It seems like it was one of those things that existed just for that one moment in the movie, you know. I also think that a bigger flaw in the movie is when the droids get in the shuttle pod and they launch. And then the one guy says, well, should we blast it? And the guy goes, well, you know, don't waste your lasers, which again makes no sense because lasers don't, you know, it's not like they're wasting bullets and it's not as if the Empire is not shooting things constantly. But he says, no, no, hold your fire. There's no life forms on board. Well, this is a huge problem for me. Because they make it seem as if the only thing that would matter is if there was life forms on board. Even though they know that droids are of value. Droids may have information that they need. And they know this. Later on, they find, oh, crap, we need to find these droids. Well, kind of makes me wonder, did the guy get fired? Who said, oh, it doesn't matter, there's no life forms on board, and all we care about is life forms, even though it never occurred to anybody that possibly droids might have the information, the stolen plans that they're looking for. I also thought it was odd that this whole movie revolves around stolen plans. It always makes you wonder, isn't it possible that stolen plans may have been copied? I mean, okay, maybe the Star Wars universe is different and maybe they don't have computers the way we do, but, I mean, if they're just plans, you could just copy them down on a piece of paper. I mean, you could just, you know, it's not that difficult, but they make it seem like these plans are some sort of physical thing that can only be transported from one person to the other person. And again, I know this is nitpicky, but it sounds like the kind of nitpicking that people would make about the prequels. And I imagine if the prequels were made first and A New Hope was made later, this is probably what we would hear Mr. Plinkett saying. Oh, this is stupid, you know. How do you expect you're going to get the plans back? Even if they had found the droids and said, okay, we got the plans, they wouldn't know whether those plans were copied and sent elsewhere. I mean, nobody would know. So, again, this is a big problem. Then we get down to Tatooine and, you know, we have this situation with Luke Skywalker. I actually think that Luke Skywalker is not a good actor, at least Mark Hamill. Luke Skywalker is not an actor, but I don't think Mark Hamill did a really good job. I think later in the movies he does a little better, but I think in that movie his acting isn't so fantastic. You know, he exhibits a lot of sort of the whiny characteristics that Anakin does. Also, when he finds his parents charred to a crisp, and that's the only time we see anybody really gruesomely murdered in Star Wars. So it's pretty gruesome. I mean, to come home and to find essentially people that raised you since the time you were a baby. And, you know, like if I came home and I found my parents just charred corpses, I think I'd be pretty shaken up by it. And we do see Luke is like, whoa, you know, that's kind of crappy. But then it just seems like he forgets about it. He's like, I don't know if he internalizes it. But he goes, oh, well, parents are charred. Let's move on. I mean, I don't know. I guess he really hated his aunt and uncle. But he really doesn't seem to be very moved by it. You know, when Uncle Ben dies in Spider-Man, I mean, you know, Spider-Man's really torn up about it, but you know, Luke's a, you know, and Uncle Charlie Crisp, oh well, shit happens. You know, on to the next thing. I don't think that's very good drama for me, you know. Later, you know, we meet Han Solo, Millennium Falcon. I think a lot of that stuff is great, except for Han says, you know, 12 parsecs, which again, this is, to me, it's a ridiculous oversight. Because it's not like, you know, Lucas couldn't have just picked up a science book and flipped through it and said, a parsec is a measurement of distance and not a speed or a time. It's so it would be like saying, you know, I drove from my house to my job in 10 miles. And people would say, well what does that mean? That doesn't mean anything. So what, you know? So maybe that's nitpicking. I don't know. But I think that's, you know, that's one of those things, again, that probably would have been attacked like crazy. Moving on from there, we have the Death Star, which I think is really wonderful. But the thing I wondered about the Death Star, and this never really comes up, is how does the Death Star get from place to place? Everybody just assumes that somehow the Death Star just suddenly appears here, and then it just suddenly appears over there. I'm like, how does that happen? How does that happen that it just goes from place to place? Does it move? Does it have thrusters? I mean, you never see it move on screen. We just know that somehow it goes places. I mean, they call it a battle station, but then there really isn't a battle station. It would have to be a giant, enormous spaceship that somehow moves around the galaxy. Because how does it get to Alderaan? How does it get to where it's going to Yavin? You know, how does it do that? It to me, it's just an oversight. Now I think probably the biggest flaw of the movie in A New Hope is when Princess Leia is brought in. She's interrogated by Darth Vader. And this is also a big problem. Now, if you're looking at A New Hope by itself, then it doesn't seem to be as much of an issue. Because at that point, we don't know that Darth Vader is her father. So we don't know that. But later on, it's established that they're father and daughter. And so here he is in a room with his daughter. He is extremely Force-sensitive. She's supposedly Force-sensitive. And it never even is hinted at. It's never even suggested that they may have a connection, that there may be something between them. You don't see that. And then later, in Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi, we're expected to believe that Lucas had this planned out all along. I don't think so. I don't think that Lucas knew that they were related, or that even Luke was Vader's son. I think this was something that when the Empire Strikes Back came out, I think Lucas decided to put that back into the story, or he just made it up. And again, if these movies were made in, you know, the 2000s, I think they would be torn apart for this. This would have been seen as a majorly contrived plot point that nobody would put up with. And again, let's not forget Leia's sudden British accent. Throughout the whole movie, she has an American accent. But when she's around other British actors, she starts speaking with a British accent. And then she loses the British accent later when she's around American actors again. And she's even admitted to this. She's even said, well, you know, I was surrounded by all these people with a British accent, and then I just figured, might as well use a British accent too. I mean, again, Mr. Plinkett would have torn this apart if this was in the newer movies. This would have been a major, major criticism. So, but I think that the worst part of the movie is when the Death Star blows up Alderaan. When Tarkin says, you know, Dantooine is too far to make a good example, so we're going to blow up your planet instead. Now imagine that the planet you lived on, imagine Earth, where all your family lives, all your friends, all your relatives, all your aunts and uncles, everyone you've ever loved, everyone you've ever cared about, everything you've ever cared about, every place you've ever been, every place you have a fond memory of, your home, your school, places you grew up with, all that is obliterated in seconds. And Leia acts like, you know, she ordered french fries and she got, you know, fried mushrooms instead. What's this? This isn't what I ordered. That is exactly the level of emotion that she displays when her entire planet is blown up and everyone she's ever known is dead. Now, to me, you know, if we're going to talk about bad acting, if we're going to talk about an unrealistic reaction, I think that's a really good... That always bothered me when I was younger. I was like, man, she took that well, you know. The only time when we see any real emotion in this movie is when Obi-Wan Kenobi dies. Now, Obi-Wan Kenobi must be the biggest liar in Star Wars. Not only does he tell Luke that, you know, Vader murdered his dad. Again, we can say, if we just look at A New Hope by itself, not as part of a trilogy, this doesn't matter. But when he tells Vader, if you strike me down, I will become more powerful than you can possibly imagine. Well, that doesn't happen, really. Vader strikes him down. He sacrifices himself, supposedly to get more power than Vader can imagine. But what does that power entail? Whispering in Luke's ear, use the Force? I mean, that's all he really does. He really doesn't do anything that shows that he has any sort of great power, you know? However, when he does get killed, Luke freaks out. Oh my God! No, Ben, you know? Uncle Ben, no, you know? He's so distraught over it. And he goes into the Millennium Falcon, he goes, oh, I can't believe he's gone. You know, what do you mean? You just met the guy 3 days ago. How emotional could you really get about a guy dying that you just met? I mean, I suppose you can say, well, you know, maybe he viewed him as kind of a surrogate father since his uncle died, and now he lost everybody he knows. I can see that, I guess. But again, you know, maybe it's a delayed reaction. From, you know, he's still thinking about his aunt and uncle. I don't know. But it really seems like he gets so distraught over the death of someone he just met. But people that he lived with all his life, he didn't care much for them. And he cared more about his death. I mean, that's the most dramatic moment in the movie. His death, not the destruction of Alderaan, his death. Again, I mean, it just seemed a little odd, you know, that happened. And why did he sacrifice himself? So that he can just, you know, become a ghost in Luke's ear. Like, to me, it seems a little silly. And it's never really explained if Jedi can do that and how they do it and why they do it. Never explained in the trilogy. It's just something that... It's just a silly kind of attempt to make allusions, I think, to Christianity, I think. And it's not a very good one, I think. I think it's worse than the virgin birth thing that they referenced with Anakin. Now, the last thing is this whole idea of blowing up the Death Star, because now they have the Death Star plans, and they can blow it up because they know of an exhaust port, and that if you throw a torpedo in this exhaust port, it's going to blow up the whole thing. Now, I think to me, this is an incredible oversight. Now, again, we don't know how these alien technologies works in this other universe, but it seems to me that if you just put anything to block this exhaust port, I mean, an exhaust port doesn't really need to be that big. And if it needed to be that big, I don't see why they couldn't put some lasers over it, or, I don't know, like a screen door or something that could still vent heat or whatever they need to vent. And as long as there's some physical object there blocking it from our torpedo, it wouldn't blow up. So it seems like whoever built the Death Star was a complete idiot. And this is what the whole movie hinges around. The whole movie hinges around this one thing. Now, before they go to blow it up, you see Han Solo saying, you know, this is suicide. And he's going to get on board his Millennium Falcon and fly away. And Leia's really kind of mad at him, and Luke's mad at him. How could you just take your money and run? Well, and it's kind of, and he's kind of made out to be portrayed as this greedy guy that doesn't care about anything other than himself. But he defends himself, and he says, well, you know, you guys are going to attack that thing. That's suicide. And the thing is, he's right. Everybody who attacked that thing died, like everybody, except for Wedge Antilles and Luke Skywalker, and him later on. But it was suicide. And then I don't think that makes him a selfish, greedy, bad person to say, I don't want to undertake a mission that's completely insane and has no chance of success. To me, that doesn't really seem like, that doesn't make him all that bad of a person. And even later when he does help out, you know, Leia says, I knew there was more to you than money. Maybe it wasn't about the money. It was like, look, I don't want to die. You know, to me, that's a big part of, you know, to me, it's very understandable. You know, maybe I'm a coward, but I probably wouldn't do that either. You know, if I had to attack a castle full of hundreds of armed guards and only had like three people with slingshots, I would say, you know what, I'm not gonna go over there. I'm not gonna do that. You know, so. I mean, Han admittedly was very heroic when he flew in and saved the day at the last minute, but I don't think it makes him a bad person to say, hey, I'd rather not do this, you know. Finally, we have this epic shot, this epic torpedo shot, and as Stan Lee has pointed out on YouTube, all of this is a flaw, and the reason it's a flaw is because even if this thing is 2 meters wide, they're in space, in spaceships. They don't need to fly by this thing going 100 miles an hour, dropping a torpedo. All they need to do is stop the ship right over the hole and drop it in. That's all they got to do. They can just land the craft and just drop in the torpedo. I mean, I don't really see why the problem is, well, we have to zoom over it super fast and drop it in. You know, I don't see why that's such a problem. I mean, even say that the fighters are so small that it's hard for the turbo lasers to hit them. So, to me, again, the fact that the entire movie hinges around this idea that, you know, we got to drop this torpedo in, when, you know, even in today's, with today's technology, we would have just been able to just drop, you know, just hover over it with a helicopter, just drop in the bomb. No, dropping a couple bombs, you know, just in case the first one doesn't hit directly. Just dropping a whole bunch of them, you know. It's one of those contrivances that doesn't make the movie that convincing. But the thing is, the movie was made in the 70s, and it had flaws. And there's a lot more that I could talk about. I could talk about the fact that when they're in the trash compactor, the trash is floating on top of the water, even though it's supposed to be metal. It's obviously styrofoam because you see it float. You know, the fact that the stormtroopers are complete idiots and can't hit anything, even though they're shooting at each other point blank range, and no good guy ever gets hit for some reason. There's a lot of flaws in the first movie and in the later movies. But you know, this is a movie that changed people's lives. Why? Because people were young when they saw it. They were young, and because the movie was full of imagination, it was full of creativity, it was full of wonderful ideas, and the flaws just didn't matter that much. And that's exactly how I feel about the prequels. They're not flawless, they're not perfect, but the good things that are in those movies more than make up for the bad. And that's my position. So if you don't like it, you know, you're entitled to hate what you want and love what you want. It's free country. But that's my reason for why I think the prequels don't deserve the hate that they get.